From the right, I'm Matt Lewis.
From the left, I'm Bill Scher.
And you're watching
The Week in Block.
Really, Bill, not a lot to talk about this week unless you're going to talk about healthcare or the bizarreness of Representative Eric Massa.
The two most important stories in the entire planet.
And both are related, of course. Let's start with Massa.
Sure.
It's such a bizarre story, and things continue to come out. But this has been great for bloggers to talk about. The latest thing I'm seeing is, and by the way, someone on Twitter had direct messaged me. Someone I know on Twitter direct messaged me a few, you know, right when this story first broke, like the very beginnings, and said, "Hey, I know a staffer that used to work for him who lived with him." And Ace of Spades actually has a picture, and it says he's not the clean sort of gay guy either. God Almighty, all that's missing is a trident. They actually have a picture here. Oh, man, this is about as bad as the Mark Foley thing, maybe worse because there's a lot going on here. They actually have a picture of this apparently dorm room sort of house where Eric Massa – lived in apparently he paid, at a house on East Street Southeast yesterday, which Massa had shared with five of his staffers. Clothes were piled on the floor and half a dozen pair of shoes mingled with dirty towels next to an open pink suitcase in the living room. I guess that was from The Hill, and Ace of Spades was quoting it. But bizarre. It says... the headline of the Ace of Spades piece is, Massa hired lots of young gay men, paid them so little they had to live with him in his weird gay frat house. Wow, what an interesting story, and that's just one element of it.
And that's it. So that's someone who had fed this to you anonymously?
Okay, well, so I first heard that Eric Massa was living with staffers. I first learned of this from someone I know via Twitter who direct messaged me on Twitter like the minute that the allegations broke in the very beginning, before he resigned, before he was on back, all that.
This is after he said, "I'm not going to run for re-election again."
I don't even think it was after that. It was just as news was first leaking out that he was in some sort of trouble. Is that how we found out about it?
Well, my recollection of the chronology was he announced all of a sudden he wasn't going to run for re-election again, and he attributed it to health problems. And then, you know, within that news cycle, it came out that there was some kind of investigation going on.
Okay. So, yeah, and it would have been after that. But, I mean, yeah. I never ran with it. I didn't do anything with it because it's, you know, it was hearsay. But frankly, the story is so weird. This is just one element. I mean, another weird thing was, like, Washington was enthralled by his appearance on Glenn Beck the other day. Everybody was tweeting about it, and nothing happened. I mean, I attribute it to Geraldo's opening Al Capone's vault and finding nothing inside. I thought this thing started off being great television. I mean, say what you will about Glenn Beck, but he is uniquely suited to have Massa on. And I was thinking Massa, if he has any information, and by the way, I've always contended it's equally possible for him. They're not mutually exclusive. It's very possible that Massa could be a complete jerk and be right about Rahm Emanuel at the same time. And I thought there's a chance he's going to deliver the goods on Rahm on national television, and it was a huge letdown. Not because I was hoping that he would bring down Rahm, but just because it was so dramatic and could have been
such
good television.
Wasn't my question as far as conservative bloggers go? There was definitely, I mean, actually, I take that back. I know there was sort of a bit of a split on how to treat Massa. I know Michelle Malkin and some others were saying,
yes,
stay away from this guy.
Yeah.
But there was some element of the right that was excited that, okay, you know, Massa's going to drop the dime on Rahm, and we're going to find out how completely corrupt, you know, the Obama White House really is. These awful Chicago politics, and here's a guy who clearly has every incentive to drop whatever dimes he has.
Right.
He goes on Beck. He has nothing of anything, you know, it's just sort of standard, you know, wash and arm twisting, which is, you know, how politics executed whoever's in charge, nothing unethical, no bribes, no quid pro quo or anything like that. Does that make anyone on the right say, huh, maybe this isn't the most corrupt White House on the planet. Maybe they just are practicing politics like politicians do.
Well, first of all, you're entirely right to say that Michelle Malkin was right on this from the beginning. She wrote, crap weasel is too kind a description for the desperate bottom-feeding Massa. He is not a useful idiot. He's just an idiot. And she wrote this early on. I was listening to the talk radio, as I am prone to do, when this story broke. And by the way, the first story, if he had had information like this for Beck, it would have been great. The story about Rahm Emanuel approaching him naked, poking him in the chest. That was obviously a great story. Who knows if it's true or not. I tend to think it's probably true, but nobody has evidence that it happened. But in any event, that was a fascinating story. And had he had more to share with Beck, it would have been very good. I think, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, the first day that broke, they never held him up as a hero. But they were, I think, gleeful that he was essentially making the allegation that that Rahm was behind forcing him out because he had voted no for health care. Again, I don't think the two things are mutually exclusive. I think it's entirely plausible.
Are you right? I had a tweet myself where once Massa argued that he was forced out, like that in itself to me exposed the idiocy of his argument, because you can't get forced out of Congress. You choose to resign.
Well,
unethically pressure you out, you'd say, screw you, I'm staying and I'm still voting no. What's making you quit?
My take, though, Bill, was that Rahm had the goods on him and that Rahm was going to come forward and expose his
lifestyle. He's simultaneously saying, I did not do these things. I am quitting. And they forced me out, which doesn't make any sense.
I would say that it's entirely possible that Massa is a jerk. He is a horrible human being. He is a liar. And he abused his staff, or at least, took advantage of them. And Rahm knew about it. And Rahm basically went to him and said, look, if I'm going to expose you unless you vote right on health care. I think that's entirely possible that that both those things happen. Now, who knows? I don't know. Can't prove it. Obviously, we can't take Massa's word for it. He's obviously a liar. He's obviously not credible. So we'll never know probably until the next Mark Halperin book comes out.
Well, listen, this is sort of, I'd say the downside of blogging, where there is really extremely little to go. If you think there is a scandal here, there's extremely little to go on. I mean, a scandal in terms of how the Democratic Party treated the situation. There's obviously enough to go on to say that Massa deserved to be investigated, at least. Not that he's presumed guilty, but there was enough for an investigation, and that investigation was proceeding. Now it is canceled because he quit. The House Ethics Committee can't investigate a non-member. Maybe there'll be a criminal investigation if someone wants to pursue it. But there's not a lot to go on as far as how it was treated, although there is going to be, at least the Health Ethics Board is going to look into how the Democratic leaders treated the situation. And maybe there is something there. I think the proper thing to do is to let the Health Ethics Committee look into it. But those of us on the outside have nothing of substance to go on, because there is no one credible making an argument with any evidence that something untoward happened here.
Well, I think the thing that's happening today, and just like the healthcare debate, there are so many moving parts that tomorrow there'll be another shoe to drop. But the latest today is the argument that, and let me read you a couple quotes here. Red State's Mark Impumini says the Eric Massa sideshow just became a full-fledged election year scandal aimed like a dagger directly at the Democrats' House majority. Hot Air's a la pundit, very sarcastically talking that Pelosi's been so honest and forthright up until now. I guess we have no choice but to believe that her staff simply forgot to tell her that a formal ethics inquiry featuring explosively sorted charges was being launched, yada, yada, yada. Kalo over at the corner writes, a glaring question I continue to have is, if there were complaints over a year ago about Massa, was someone sitting on them for a year before we're told Holder and Pelosi knew? So this is being compared to the Mark Foley situation, where,
I think in the Mark Foley situation, though, you had we ended up with more evidence that the Republican leaders directly that sat on the information inappropriately. Right now, from what you're quoting, just there, these conservative blogs, is speculation that maybe Democrat leaders sat on this, but no one has actually got any goods on that. And again, it's perfectly appropriate to have the House Ethics Committee to look into it. As any individual blogger has the right to muse to his or her heart's content, but as that bleeds into the actual media coverage, I think it's when, you know, more eyebrows get to be raised. So you have Matt Iglesias.
What did Nancy Pelosi know, and when did she know it?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, every blogger that wants to gin up a scandal wants to get that to be the question. Cover up worse than the crime, blah, blah, blah. But Matt Iglesias wrote on his blog, I really think the political journalists who spent more than 20 minutes over the past 24 hours, this was posted Wednesday afternoon, more than 20 minutes over the past 24 hours covering the Eric Massa story, need to turn the TV off, turn the BlackBerry off, turn the Twitter off, shut everything down, go to a nice quiet room, take a deep breath, look in the mirror and ask themselves why they got into this business. How many reporters are covering the story? What are the odds that some important fact of Massa's life will go unrevealed if you do not devote your talents and energies to looking into it? Isn't it more likely you're going to commit useful journalism by looking into something else? Anything else? Like, literally, anything else.
All right, but so, I mean, but I think, so along yeah, those
I
lines, though.
This, I mean, you're right that I'm sure there are liberals who were very giddy about the Mark Foley story, who were saying, right, Go look at the Eric Massa story.
And let me just give you a sense, since it's the weekend
blog. There's not a lot to go on in the Massa story other than Massa himself is not a credible person who, if he's not presumed guilty, certainly isn't doing a lot to make it argue that he isn't guilty.
Just to underscore and agree with you about the hypocrisy point, Hot Air's Ala Pundit wrote, funny, but I don't remember many Democratic complaints about the sustained media swarm over Mark Foley in fall 2006 while Iraq was falling apart. I'm sure there's an explanation for the difference somewhere. So, anyway, it is interesting. And I guess apparently Patrick Kennedy, right, had some sort of a rant about this, that people were paying attention to this, right, and not the issues that matter, like Denis Kucinich's 3 hours were trying to end the Iraq war or whatever that failed.
Shall we shift to healthcare?
Yes. And it's a good segue because Massa was...
Well, I mean, maybe one point, a Massa segue to healthcare,
yeah,
if I
please.
May. You know, there definitely was a Netroots contingent that really, you know, thought very highly of Massa because he, not only was he a diehard single-payer advocate, he was a diehard single-payer advocate despite being in a swing district. And he ran very vociferously on single payer and won in that district. And so he was sort of similar to Alan Grayson in Florida, someone who's being very forthrightly liberal and winning on that. So he was seen as a good example, even though I believe Massa had other aspects of his record that are not liberal. I mean, he was a former Republican.
He was?
I believe he was.
I didn't know that.
Feel free to fact check. I believe I read that recently that he was a former Republican.
Interesting.
And when this first happened, you know, when he just said he wasn't running for re-election, he wasn't going to resign right away, you know, I think you, and there were some rumors about investigations that you saw some liberals rally to him, say it's that he's being treated unfairly, he's being sort of, you know, kicked in the face when he's announced his health problem, because he voted no on health care because it wasn't single payer. After the Glenn Beck interview, and you had that blaring headline Huffington Post, you know, that said, you know, wreck on Beck, I think you saw a lot fewer liberal bloggers saying, oh, I'm not sure we're going to stick my neck out for this guy anymore.
Well, and along those lines, Bill, I mean, this ties into the whole Marcos Melitzis thing, where he was on TV. I guess it was a guest host filling
on Countdown
for Olbermann. And he said that if Kucinich votes against Obamacare, that he should be primaried. Of course, the deadline has passed, so that would be probably a 2012 primary. But still, I think what's your take? I mean, does that influence?
Well, so much of the energy on the left has been, how do we primary the conservative Dems,
right,
the right-leaning Dems, the blue dogs, and, you know, Fire Dog Lake and Down with Tyranny, you know, really put a lot of energy into that. I talked with Melissa Clothier last week about how the blogosphere energies to defeating Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, you know, enticed a prominent person, Lieutenant Governor of Arkansas, to join that primary. So for, you know, Coase, over the course of his blogging tenure, you know, has often thrown elbows to the farther left, you know, parts of the spectrum. But he hadn't done that much lately. You know, most of his ire has been towards the conservative Dems. So for him to sort of come back and say, look, you know, this healthcare bill may not be perfect, but to be the deciding vote in killing it, regardless of your reasoning, left or right, that deserves a primary. That was a notable thing for Coase to do, and it prompted Ian Welsh, a Huffington Post blogger, also blogs at his own site, to then attack Coase and say, you know, you're the one who's going to divide the progressive movement if you're going to try to primary one of the most prominent progressive figures in the country. So there's definitely not a unified view on how, and I talked with Melissa last week, there's definitely not unanimity in the liberal blogosphere how to approach this compromise healthcare bill. I think you are seeing in other parts of the liberal movement, you know, a general acceptance of it. You saw this big rally this week, you know, led by Healthcare for America Now and MoveOn.org, pushing for it. You know, my own group, Campaign for America's Future, is demanding an up and down vote in its most recent, you know, action email. But within the blogosphere, there's still, you know, consternation about it. And Jane Hampshire of Fire Dog Lake had a long essay earlier saying, no, I'm not going to whip people to support this bill. I'm not going to ask people to expend their energies where it's not needed. And I'm going to turn my attention to student loan reform, where I think a grassroots push might actually have an impact. So there is definitely division in the liberal blogosphere on how to deal with this bill.
It is interesting. And I feel like it's number one, I mean, the last thing I heard, and talk about the deadlines and the expectations, right? It was going to be August, and then it was going to be Thanksgiving, and then it was going to be Christmas, and then it was going to be, you know, right now, I mean, things change every day. They could vote tomorrow and pass healthcare for all I know. Nobody knows, and this thing is constantly evolving. But from where I sit today, I'm skeptical about this self-imposed March 18th deadline. Again, I'm not sure they're going to make that.
Yeah, I, you know, the White House sort of floated 18th, it wasn't quite do or die, but, you know, Obama leaves for Indonesia on that date, and so they tried to push that as a deadline. I think everyone agrees that the CBO has to weigh in. They haven't weighed in yet. They might weigh in by the time this gets posted on bloggeds.tv. If there was some talk, it could be Friday when they would score the president's compromise proposal. That would be the basis of the reconciliation changes. But I think there's a greater sense in Congress. I do a lot of Pat Buchanan hand chops, by the way. I don't know why.
that's I love he. You know what? You're right. He does like that Bruce Lee hand chop thing, and he gets away with it. Other people, it would seem threatening.
I probably can't. but the Easter recess starts at the end of the month, and I think Democrats are concerned that you'll have another Tea Party invasion of congressional town halls that will give this impression that the bill is wildly unpopular. And I think that would be a distortion of the poll numbers. We can go back and forth about that.
Let's not.
they don't want to have to deal with that kind of pushback again. And so they'd rather just get this done. One, they want to get it done as fast as they can because they want to get to other parts of the agenda, particularly jobs. They don't want this to be hanging over their heads for the course of the year. They want to tie it off. But there's still a herding cats problem, you know, probably more so in the House than the Senate at this point, because if the Senate's going to, the Senate bill is passed with 60. It's a question of the House passing that and then having the reconciliation changes, which can go without 60 in the Senate, but they'll probably have the 50. It's a question of Pelosi now getting 216 when that seems to be what's fluid here.
So the nuclear option has been bandied about a lot. Red State's Brian Darling, President Obama is advocating the use of the budget reconciliation process to pass Obamacare. The procedure, also referred to as Obamacare nuclear option and the healthcare nuclear option.
I'm not seeing the words nuclear option used in the liberal blogosphere so much about this point, by the way. That seems to be a conservative thing.
Michelle Malkin, it's official after months of threatening to push the button on the so-called nuclear option reconciliation. The parliamentary maneuver that Harry Reid said nobody is talking about and President Obama said Americans didn't care about last month is a go. Dan Real, that I think he's with Real World, that this is an expensive travesty of a chief executive Obama, more a byproduct of timing and media collaboration than his own worth or accomplishment, is personally advocating for the so-called nuclear option is the final straw. Your listeners and our viewers will note that I do say the word nuclear correctly.
Much appreciated. I'm just trying to pull up the couple of blog posts I had about this that are not at the tip of my tongue. On the reconciliation point. I do. You mentioned Reid saying that no one's talking about it. You know, there were liberal and conservative blogs that kind of raised their eyebrows when he said
that. Right, and that was during the bipartisan, the summit, right.
Yeah, I mean, talking with his memo, you know, it's like, what are you talking about, Harry? Everybody's talking about it. You're talking
he
about
He talked about it like 2 days before on the Hill, he mentioned.
What's that?
Like 2 days before he said that, he mentioned reconciliation like in the Hill or in Roll Call or something.
Right. I do think if you look at Reid saying it, I think he was stumbling over his words to some extent. And I don't think he was trying to say that literally nobody was talking about it. He was trying to say no one is talking about it if we can find bipartisan support. Because obviously it would be patently stupid for Reid to say something that he was just talking about himself 2 days ago and has talked about repeatedly since
then.
Maybe your argument is Harry Reid is the stupidest man on the planet, but I don't think that's.
I don't think he's stupid, but I think he's I just think he's a bad spokesman for Democrats.
Well, right, and he can be clumsy with his words. I think he was just being clumsy there. And to that end, he just sent a letter to Mitch McConnell, which reads, quote, "As you know, the vast majority of bills developed through reconciliation were passed by Republican Congresses and signed into law by Republican presidents, including President Bush's massive budget-busting tax breaks for multimillionaires. Given this history, one might conclude that Republicans believe a majority vote is sufficient to increase the deficit and benefit the super-rich, but not to reduce the deficit and benefit the middle class. Either way, alternatively, perhaps Republicans believe a majority vote is appropriate only when Republicans are in the majority. Either way, we disagree." That prompted Paul Krugman to blog that and say, Harry gives him hell, wow. And then Ezra Klein also said, this can be summed up as reconcile this. So, one, it's not as if Harry Reid is shying away from talking about it. He's talking about it very explicitly. And two, if you read Paul Krugman's column or blog,
I try not to.
Is not a guy who readily pats Democrats on the head. He's been very harsh towards Obama. Very harsh towards Congress.
Really?
Feckless.
Paul Krugman? Krugman? I don't know how I say it. I can't stand reading that guy. I can't stand him.
He does not like any of these, even the slightest feints towards bipartisanship. He thinks they're disastrous. He said about Obama that he was giving up on him after what he said about Wall Street.
You know who I like, Bill? That George Will guy. That George F. Will. There's a columnist.
Reid impressed Paul Krugman. So I thought that was notable on the reconciliation front.
Well, it is it will be interesting to watch. And I wanted to thank Melissa Clothier for filling in ably last week.
We had a delightful time.
Yeah, she's terrific, very smart. And but I'm happy to be back. Good to be back here this week, and good to catch up with you.
Always happy to talk to you. The other healthcare aspect that's churning in the liberal blogosphere is what happens to the public option. And there's been a online drive to pressure senators to say, I will support public option in reconciliation. And they've actually got it up to 41 now. I think Ted Kaufman at Delaware was the most recent. And that was highlighted on Huffington Post, even though this is not getting a lot of attention in the media. Then you had a roll call story on Thursday, which said that Dick Durbin is telling senators, look, even if you support public option like me, we may have to ask you to vote against it if someone's going to put this on the floor during the reconciliation process, because we can't have anything that's going to slow down the bill's progress. You know, that's prompted, Fire Dog Lake and others to, also Daily Kos, to really go after Durbin. You know, you're actually whipping against the public option now, even though this thing has some momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another aspect of how this process is depressing parts of the progressive base.
Well, and there's an interesting thing happening on the right where, and I hesitate to go into this because this literally every minute things change, but as of yesterday, there was a thought that they would, that Stupak and his block of pro-life Democrats might vote for the Senate version with the promise being that abortion would be stripped, that the abortion, federal funding of abortion, would be stripped in reconciliation and would be fixed so that and he would be given probably a letter or some sort of promise of that happening.
You're referring to the Senate language regarding federal funding of abortions would get stripped out.
Yeah.
Separate.
But now the interesting,
so I guess some are saying it can't be dealt with in reconciliation directly. It's not germane enough to the budget.
Yes, exactly. And the interesting thing is that it would be Republicans who would join that effort. Do you know about this? I think there were like 40 Republicans who signed a letter. And so basically it's a game of chicken, really high stakes chicken, where they're saying to Stupak, if you vote yes, you're voting for abortion because we're going to block the changes. I think it's the Byrd rule. And so what an interesting position where Republicans could essentially be voting for a pro-abortion bill, or at least threatening to. So it is fascinating. I think it's a moot point at this point.
There are, I should say, other interpretations of the Senate language, by the way. Not all would characterize it as pro-abortion.
Yeah, I know that there's...
Most pro-choice organizations think it's disastrous language.
Yeah, I know that there are differing opinions on that. But in any event, think of the drama there. And it's funny for me to watch. I'm a pro-life conservative. But I'm very...
You're also a fan of political theater.
I'm a fan of political theater, but I'm also a realist. And I'm very skeptical of Stupak. And so is Eric Erickson at Red State. So is Rush Limbaugh. I'm skeptical that he... I don't trust – how do I put this? I don't trust Stupak enough to trust him with the future of this passing or not passing. I'll put it to you that way. But it's funny
I don't think you have much choice as far as who you're going to cast your trust in.
Well, it's funny that these –
he's the only guy that probably could derail
these it. These pro-life groups, which to me strike me as even though we're on the same side, as somewhat quixotic – or naive might be a better word in this case. Stupak's gonna, you know, I think if Stupak can figure out a way to pass Obamacare and to amend it somehow to prohibit federal funding of abortion, he will vote for it. Can they do that? Can they come up with that? You know, can they get away with it in a parliamentary maneuver? I don't know, but. But it's fascinating.
Well, I mean, I think you've seen this in almost every vote that's been taken, serious vote's been taken, and this is the part of the process that I think drives a lot of people crazy. There's always a significant block of Democrats that refuse to take stands until they absolutely have to try to maximize their leverage. And this is why there's always pressure put on by either Obama or Reid or Pelosi, because they know unless they cut off debate at some point, these guys just won't move off the fence.
But I think
they're not inclined to, you know, state their views, you know, early.
But I think in terms of conservatives not trusting Stupak, I think a lot of conservatives felt really burned by Ben Nelson. Because Ben Nelson went all the way to the end saying, on principle, I'm going to oppose this thing. And then he sold out at the last minute. So I think that if Stupak sells out on this, there will be it will be generally accepted that the worst Republican is better than the best Democrat. The whole notion.
Well, I think you've also seen, you know, on people from the left and the right within Congress, they will often say seemingly absolutist things. There's no way I'm voting for this if it's got that. And then they don't fall through on that.
Yes, exactly.
I think it drives the left mad when they see liberals, you know, not following through on their threats, and it drives conservatives when conservative-leaning Democrats don't follow through on their threats. And you just don't know until it's actual crunch time that bill is on the floor. I'm sorry, you were saying?
I was saying I think you are absolutely right, Bill. I completely agree with you, and it's maddening to me.
We always agree.
You know, someone, I think her name's Terry Ann, someone on Twitter, because, look, I think the commenters were a little harsh to Melissa last week. And I explained to her that our commenters are generally mean people who don't like...
They're the worst audience on the planet.
They don't like me either.
You hate me, and I hate
you. Yes, that's our relationship. And if I ever leave, I'm confident that whoever the next person is will hear that Matt Lewis was better. Just like,
well,
I hear that about
Con. You know, Con Carroll, you know, got all sorts of guff when he was on with me regularly. And the day he left, it always was, Matt Lewis is no Con Carroll.
Yes.
That guy was brilliant.
Big shoes to fill.
Whereas I've been here, you know, since, you know, 1963. So I'm always a dude.
I mean, yeah, when you started, it was like the Weekend Xerox or something like that. The Weekend Long Distance AT&T phone calls. So.
The purity test is sweeping the nation. I got a carbon copy of it.
The Weekend Telegrams. Twit. No, but this chick, Terry Ann, or Terry Ann Online, Terry Ann, I don't know what her tweet. She's a conservative on Twitter. She had the audacity to say that I don't challenge you. And here's my take on that. Number one, the one thing that we do get complimented on is our rapport, that you and I get along, we like each other personally, and it's the one place in this bitter, you know, acrimonious debate where you can get two people, you know, talking. But the other thing is, it is not our mandate to argue about politics. That is not what this show is
about.
Mandate
is to discuss what's percolating in the blogosphere and its impact on the national discourse.
Absolutely. And it's more of an analysis. And so I agree. Look, if this were about debating policy, then you should probably have somebody else who's because you're more of a policy wonk than I am, and you guys could fight it out. But that's not what this show is supposed to be anyway. So we always have to remind people who are, I guess, used to the you know, the modern crossfire thing where two people have to be constantly yelling and arguing and taking opposing viewpoints and arguing about politics. It's not what this is about.
Well, the kind of movie review I hate or analysis of a political speech that I hate is when someone's complained that it didn't do what I wanted to do. You left this thing out that I wanted you to say or what have you, as opposed to analyzing it for what it was trying to achieve.
Right.
You know, if you want us to be fact checking every last thing that we say to each other, that's not this forum. that's something else.
Yeah, there should be another blogging head show that talks about this show. I think there's actually a Martha Stewart show that talks about Martha Stewart's show? I think there might be.
There's probably an entire cable channel that's devoted
there,
to that.
Yeah, so who knows? They get desperate for content. So are we good, or do you want to hit on any other topics while we're here?
The only thing I touched upon quickly, okay. The Dodd financial reform bill is supposed to come out on Monday now. The news on Thursday was that even though Dodd's been talking with Corker, the Republican senator from Tennessee, about a compromise that Dodd said he was going to move on his own. But it doesn't sound like it. I guess we don't really know until he actually releases the bill, but it doesn't sound like it means that Dodd's going to all of a sudden do pure liberal bill. Because he's still saying nice things about Corker, yeah. Dodd is, in his statements. And Atreus, Duncan Black, at the blog, Eschaton, says, do not understand. The whole point of forging a compromise is to get a deal done. I don't get why Democrats like to stick with the compromise even when there's no deal. The point is to say, quote, support this or we're going to pass some crazy commie hippie stuff. So
enter Eric Cartman.
And Tim Fernholz at Tapped had a similar point, although not as colorfully expressed. But this is something else that is, driving, liberal bloggers a little batty, especially because there's a sense that if Democrats are being politically weighed down by seeming too close to Wall Street, here's your chance to break free of it. Why are you mucking it up by offering very milquetoasty reforms?
Now, it's interesting because Bob Corker is not very popular right now on the right.
He had the temerity to actually talk to a Democrat about something.
It's his plan to pass a massive new Consumer Financial Protection Agency. This is according to Adam Brickley, my former intern at Rightosphere, which is a news site. It used to be a race for 08, a race for 2012. And Adam Brickley started the Draft Sarah Palin blog. He actually was the guy who found Sarah Palin a year or two before anybody knew who she was. And he is suggesting Hank Williams Jr. Should run against Bob Corker. If Corker does indeed...
Now, I could get behind Hank Williams III when he gets Bob Corker.
Right, because he's more like hardcore than Hank Jr. Adam Brickley writes, if Corker does indeed help the Dems ram through their most massive bailout yet, he may indeed face a stiff primary challenge from a very angry Bo Cephas.
But is there any talk that he's seriously considering it?
Not yet. But then again, people laughed when Adam Brickley picked Sarah Palin.
Now, if John Cougar Mellencamp could relocate from Indiana to Tennessee.
Yes.
Or Hank Williams Jr. relocate to Indiana.
It's such a shame.
That could be a real race.
I like John Mellencamp. I like his music a lot. And a big fan of the Scarecrow album, which I think we were all assigned at some point with Frank... With Frampton Comes Alive.
You know his politics do lean left.
It's horrible, Bill. But his music is very good. And even that commercial, that truck commercial or whatever, This Is My Country or This Is Our Country, great, good music. I like his music.
But so forced to choose between John Mellencamp and Hank Williams Jr. on music alone.
You know, it's...
What would you do?
It's like... It's I love them both, man. It'd be tough. I would like to go to a concert where they both play. That would be great. I like both their music. And truthfully, I mean, they're both country-ish. I mean, John Mellencamp was, on rock radio, but it's not that far removed from country. It's a little bit crossover. It's
Oh, and his newer stuff would be seen on, CMT
actually,
and GAC.
Yeah.
It's not going to get a lot of top 40 airplay anymore.
I mean, nowadays Bon Jovi is on CMT, so.
Yes, that was very sad. I mean, Bon Jovi I find sad to look at, regardless of the genre he's singing, but his shift into cheesy pop country was sad.
I actually thought...
But profitable.
Well, I thought that song that they did with Sugarland was actually much better than their other new stuff that wasn't country, which was very...
Bon Jovi's new stuff or Sugarland's new
stuff? I don't know. Bon Jovi's new stuff. This Is Our Life or whatever.
Right.
But the one about Who Says You Can't Go Back or Who Says You Can't Come Home, right. Whatever. I thought that was a decent song. So
I'm a Hank Williams III sort of guy.
Well, you know who else is good is
Jennifer Nettles and Bon Jovi is not my kind of country.
The other son who's good right now is Waylon's son.
Yes, I do like Shooter Jennings.
Shooter Jennings. He's pretty good. And I like that stuff.
I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Once again, we find common ground, Bill. That's what this show's all about. You've done it again.
No, I do think the most recent Shooter Jennings album I heard was starting to leave country. He's trying to get back into, you know, more heavy metal, hard rock,
yeah.
Which apparently is where he started.
Yeah, there was a piece like in the New York Times or the Washington Post style section last week about him.
So he's got something new out?
Yeah, he's got something
new. I am very old and out of it. I get very little music put in front of me these days.
What are you talking about? You went to see They Might Be Giants just the other week.
I didn't see They Might Be Giants. David Roberts is my favorite environmental blogger. He does a music mix every year that he sent me, which actually had some great new stuff on it. Some country-ish stuff.
You know who has great taste? You know who has great taste in music and you would love is Cray Deeds. Do you ever follow him on Twitter?
I've not felt creepy about Twitter. I'm glad he has keeping himself busy.
Well, he tweets almost exclusively about music. He's a big Graham Parsons fan, as am I. He's got great taste in music. You know, his transportation plan wasn't all that great, but his taste in music is really worth checking out.
I'll take a look.
Yeah, you should. It's good stuff.
So now... As we should probably wrap things up, I should say you have Karl Rove on your podcast this week.
Yeah, Bill Scheer and Karl Rove within a week.
Right, you had me on as the opening act for Karl Rove.
Yeah, I mean, you warmed it up for him. No, Karl Rove came on my show. I got to say I'm pretty amazed that he, the same day, this was the first day of his media tour, Tuesday, the same day that he was on with Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, he also carved out a half hour to come on the Matt Lewis show. And he also went on Ed Morrissey's show over at Hot Air. It's called The Ed Morrissey Show. Pretty cool, I thought, that he was taking time out of his schedule to hit new media on his opening day. That was pretty neat.
And do you think he is trying to... is there a political objective he has in doing that? Does he feel like he can be... is he trying to show the old guard they need to get hip to new media? Or is he trying to get younger Republicans, or younger conservatives to stick with the Republican Party? What do you think his objective is?
I mean, I asked him about it, and he said that he basically told me he's always been interested in tech stuff. He had a Mac back in 1982 or something like that. I think he probably is more tech savvy than he gets credit for. But it was very cool that he came on. Very cool that he came on. It was a little bit scary. He knew everything about me. You can't tell online, but when we said hello before the taping started, he let me know that he knew a lot about me, which I actually take as a compliment, that it was cool that he did some research on me. But others may find it a subtle way of intimidation. I don't know. But in any event, I really appreciate him coming on my show. And very cool again, you know. I've only had my podcast for about a month now. And the fact that he came on the first day, and there goes my lighting. My lighting's set. It's like a timer. And so it suddenly got dark. So bear with me. But I think it was very cool. Awesome that he came on the show.
Well, you're going to return the favor to me. You're going to be on my radio show and podcast this week. So I'll be uploaded to liberaloasis.com on Saturday, and you can check out Matt Lewis's podcast at mattlewis.org.
All right, and catch us next week on The Week. And, Blog, I got to work on that segue. Check us out on Twitter at The Weekend Blog. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/TheWeekendBlog. And check us out right here on Blogging Hits TV next week. Thanks, Bill.
All right.
Have a good one.
Take care.